Dear friends, how are you today? I hope you're doing well, but it's not all getting to you. I'm Mark Golub, and I know the days just keep going on and on, Blur's Day, and it can be depressing. And I feel especially for those of you living alone. I know how hard that can be, how frightening it can be. But things are getting better. Slowly, but things are getting better. And I keep reminding you that I am with you, JBS is with you, all of us here at JBS are with you, and we care about you, and we want you to stay well and not feel alone and not to be frightened. We're all going to get through this, and we're not going to worry about how long it takes. You know the old adage, don't watch the water boil. It'll never boil if you're watching. So don't watch the water boil. Watch JBS instead. And we'll try to provide you with the best programming we possibly can, and things will get better. In fact, you know, many American states are beginning to open up in stages and with strict social distancing rules. These include Colorado, Minnesota, Montana, Georgia, Florida. And earlier this week, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, and the point person in America in terms of helping to shape administration policy, he announced that there are at least 8 COVID vaccines in clinical development. And the reasoning for states opening beaches and parks and some service establishments is that the number of coronavirus cases is no longer threatening our hospitals and our health system. The whole idea of the lockdown was to keep the curve, the number of hospitalizations, within the capacity of American hospitals to deal with and treat patients needing serious care. And that curve has been achieved thanks to the discipline and commitment of the American people. Our staying home, you and I, staying home, away from possible infections, following the rules, keeping our hands away from our mouth, nose, and eyes, keeping our hands clean, disinfecting surfaces and any packages or mail that may be delivered to our home, wearing a mask if we need to go out shopping or out for other essential errands, and staying more than 6 feet away from strangers. All of these strategies have been extremely successful in preventing our hospitals and healthcare facilities from being overwhelmed. And yes, tragically, people have died from this hideous virus. A very, very close friend of mine, a member of my Chavura for more than 40 years, Dr. Arthur Mostel, passed away this week from the coronavirus. He was 85 years of age. Like virtually everyone else his age, he had comorbidities. But he was a very active, bright, sexy man, and a passionate and eloquent supporter of the State of Israel. And before the outbreak of COVID-19, Arthur, who had lost his beloved wife Stella a number of years ago, was planning a wedding this month to his new beloved, Janet. And this is a tremendous loss to our community, to Arthur's family and his children, grandchildren, to us, his friends, and of course, most especially to Janet, to whom we send our deepest condolences and profound love. So as I've said repeatedly, as we've been meeting together on Gam Yachad, together during COVID-19, every single death is a monumental family tragedy. The world will never be the same after the loss of a loved one. Which is why we're all trying to stay safe and sound. And for those of us in the older demographic, the fact that society is beginning to open up really doesn't affect us. We're going to remain right where we are, doing exactly what we've been doing to stay safe. But society as a whole, especially for the younger people in our communities, who are much, much, much less at risk of dying even if they do contract the virus, life is beginning to reopen for them, thankfully. And our economy can begin to turn around, thankfully. And at least some of the more than 30 million Americans who've lost their jobs due to the coronavirus will begin to earn a living again. And yes, there will be more people who will contract the virus as states open up. Hopefully, the vast majority of them will be young enough and healthy enough to live through the disease, many with no symptoms at all. But the expectation is that even if there are new cases of the disease, the greatest threat, that of overwhelming our hospitals, will no longer exist. And so as long as our health system can care for those who do contract the serious case of the virus, communities are now able to begin to reopen in a socially responsible manner. And we can all hope for better days. Well, while the coronavirus tends to dominate our attention, it's not the only subject of social significance, especially in the state of Israel, which has been trying seemingly forever to create a new functioning government. If you've been following the story, you know that finally, Benny Gantz agreed to join a national unity government with Bibi Netanyahu. But the details of implementing this new unity government have been painfully difficult, and the start is still somewhere in the future. So where do things stand today? Which, by the way, is a very important date on the English calendar today. It was on May 14th of 1948 that David Ben-Gurion first read the Declaration of Independence of the Modern State of Israel, and Jewish life throughout the world has never been the same and has been so much for the better. This is an historic date, May 14th. And here we are in the year 2020, 72 years later, and political turmoil in Israel continues. So where do things stand today? For an update, we turn, as we always do now, to the former media consul for the Israeli consulate in New York, who's now, I'm pleased to say, the senior vice president of JBS, Shachar Azami. And Shachar, it is so good to see you. How have you been?
Oh, it's a pleasure to see you too, Mark. And I'm sorry to hear about Arthur. And of course, deepest condolences to you, the Chavura, to Janet. These cases, you know, it's important to remember that behind the numbers and figures mentioned by Cuomo or anybody else in the scene fighting the virus, there are real people and real lives impacted.
You're absolutely right. That's very kind of you. So, Shachar, we could do an hour on the various political machinations going on in Israel today, and maybe we'll take that hour next week. But for now, give us an overview. Where do we stand on Israel's new unity government, especially given events of the day?
Well, let me just maybe start with a quick comment that's got nothing to do with politics. You mentioned the importance of the day, May 14th, and how it impacted the lives of Jews everywhere and the lives of people everywhere. I want to relate to a few things that we just did here on JBS which were very interesting in this regard. First, learning from the Israeli experience with the Technoda of taking care of children of doctors who are dealing with COVID-19. And then a conversation that's going to be aired soon that I had with the head of Israel's Innovation Authority about what Israel is doing now as far as its innovative solutions and technological solutions for not only COVID-19, but the way our life is going to look like beyond this pandemic and preparing for the way the entire world is going to look like. This is going to impact not only Jews, but the entire world. And people are flocking to Israel online, whether it's a conference with the United Nations or in the private sector, to find those solutions. So isn't it wonderful that 72 years after Israel's re-emerged on the world stage, it is the center of gravity for all of these good things happening in our lives?
It is wonderful, and the significance should not be missed. And you're talking about a conversation we're going to see on JBS next week that you've had focusing on the next stage, and I'm very grateful. But it's important what you just reminded us about. Okay, now, we understand that Netanyahu asked for a delay in the swearing-in of the new unity government till Sunday. What's going on, Shachar?
Well, what's going on is the most common factor in any kind of political contraption in Israel, which is chaos. We're used to things happening at the very last minute. You remember, Mark, our continuous discussions and the debate about whether we're going to have a national unity government or not. And if you remember the agreement, is it going to be signed or isn't it? And then it's happening right at the very last minute, just before the president is accepting the mandate of this and extending the mandate of other. This is the nature of the beast. Now, the situation as it stands now is things are almost done. Where is the main chaos? It's within the distribution of the different powers and responsibilities, ministerial positions, vice ministerial positions, committees in the Knesset within the Likud party that was left to the end. Now, if you remember, this is national unity where blue and white and the Likud and their bloc are accepting exactly the same number of portfolios, which means that blue and white, a young party which has about 19 members of Knesset, are receiving the same number as the bloc that has dozens and dozens, and many of whom were ministers before. So the prime minister has to extinguish some of these fires. In an interesting development, and I just want to use this as an example, one of the names that we mentioned repeatedly was Orly Levy Abecassis. If you remember, we mentioned her, and she was part of the Meretz labor bloc, then she parted ways with labor, and she is actually going to be appointed as a minister in that national unity government. But on which side? Funnily enough, Orly Levy parted ways with labor and decided to create her own platform. So she's actually receiving a ministerial position by Netanyahu.
Yeah.
As part of his bloc. Now, had she not parted ways with Labour Party, she would have been a minister at a senior level as part of the Labour that joined Benny Gantz. So here she is manifesting that element of chaos. Now, to create a portfolio for Orly Levy, they had to dissect all sorts of powers and responsibilities from different ministries. So I believe that her portfolio is supposed to be called the Ministry for Community Reinforcement, focusing on combating drug issues and alcohol, which is taken from the Ministry of Internal Security, the reality that this coalition making is demanding of Israel is incredible. And it creates a most unprecedented scenarios like the one we heard a few days ago about Minister for Internal Security, Gilad Erdan, who is going to be appointed as both Israel's ambassador to the United Nations and to the United States when Ron Dermer leaves office.
Yeah, but Shachar, take one moment. You know, you've been in the diplomatic corps for years and years. It makes no sense for Israel to have the same person as the ambassador to Washington and the ambassador to the UN. What's going on here?
Is, you know, when you have to take a minister off of their position and convince them to become ambassadors, you want to make the package more appealing. Or as Henry Kissinger once said, you know, Israel's domestic policy is its foreign policy. So you want to convince Mr. Erdan to assume position, and you tell him you're not going to just be like Danny Danone, the ambassador to the United Nations. You're actually going to be the ambassador to the United States. And I believe, Mark, you're absolutely right. It's not a similar situation was in 1950 to 59 when Abba Ibn was both holding these two positions. But this is not the same world.
Yeah, that's a different world and a different guy.
A different guy, different world. The UN is the UN. It's an entire world, and it's in New York. And the political scene in Washington is in Washington, and it's a world unto its own. So it remains to be seen what's going to happen in this regard. But I just want to mention...
Yeah, but just finish it. What do you think the thinking was that if we don't give Erdogan both positions, he won't take it? And yes, therefore, Netanyahu wants him so badly where? In Washington or the UN... that he'd be willing to say something that makes no sense at all, Shachar?
Well, my guess is as follows. You have Danny Danone's position that's being vacated in the summer, and yet in Washington, according to the agreement between the parties, Ron Dermer, upon ending his term, Netanyahu will have an ambassador to Washington for the first half when he's prime minister. And then when Gantz assumes position in November of 2021, Gantz will appoint somebody on his end to be the ambassador to the U.S. So Dermer is finishing in a few months. You're barely going to have another year in which you have Bibi's representative in Washington. And then that person is going to have to be replaced. So under the circumstances and thinking, how am I going to fill a position of an ambassador for 1 year? The thinking was, we can both have this for 1 year and convince Erdogan that his position will be much more important. He's going to be the main man in the U.S. And yes, right now, when you think about the line outside of the prime minister's residence of Likud members of Knesset and former ministers expecting to become ministers, one name off the list makes Netanyahu's life a little bit easier.
Okay.
Not a hell of a lot easier, but a little bit easier.
Okay. And for our audience, you know, we've gotten to know Ron Dermer, and Danny Danone has done a fabulous job. Both men are sort of fixtures. I'm sorry to hear that they will be leaving. We'll all be sorry. And we don't know Erdogan. Who is Erdogan?
Well, Erdogan, first of all, a veteran, young, promising young. He's considered to be one of the younger cadres within the Likud, but the most promising young leaders within that party. And he has been in the position of Minister for Strategic Affairs that spearheaded the fight against the BDS movement and modern manifestations of anti-Semitism as part of that ministry. So he is rather familiar with the arena. But like you say, Mark, it takes a process because being an ambassador to the United States is much more than your occasional visit to New York or your cocktail meeting in Washington, D.C. It's getting to know the Jewish community, what the Jewish media, what JBS is, what the different denominations within the community is, just to understand the problems that persist within the community. There is a lot of work that needs to be done, and Erdogan himself attested that he is a hardworking man. So there is a lot of work that needs to be done.
Okay, I interrupted you. Continue the story.
What I wanted to say was, when it comes to the political situation in Israel, I want our audience to remember that even though coalition building takes a lot of efforts and we're seeing a bloated government with 30-odd ministers and many deputy ministers and others, the other alternative was going to a fourth round of elections. So whatever hundreds of millions of shekels costs are for this coalition government, the other option was 2 billion shekels of running through another elections, which will probably put us exactly in the same spot.
Okay. By the way, you still expect a unity government to be formed maybe this weekend?
On Sunday, the swearing-in ceremony of the government is supposed to take place.
Okay.
Right now, Netanyahu has to fix his own end of positions for Likud members. And yes, the train will move forward. That's my expectation.
Okay. And we'll talk about that next week.
Absolutely.
So,
and we'll talk about what's at the foundation of this government.
Exactly.
What are the policies? And interestingly enough, Naftali Bennett just had a press conference in Israel announcing that he will be part of the opposition. And it's very interesting to see that Yamina and that right-wing party is not going to be part of the fifth Netanyahu government to be sworn in.
Why is that, Shachar?
For real or the press statements?
For real.
Well, the discussions about establishing the new coalition, these discussions don't take place in the Prime Minister's office. They don't take place in the Knesset. They take place in the Prime Minister's residence. In attendance are the Prime Ministerial family. The Prime Ministerial family has certain feelings towards Naftali Bennett and Ayelet Shaked. So it would not be entirely naive to assume that these personal feelings play a part in how come a right-wing party like Yamina, representing the religious Zionists, is not part of the coalition, and thinking that had there been somebody else at the helm of that party, its fate might have been slightly different.
Okay, you talk about Sarah Netanyahu?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. But wait, what's going to happen to Avigdor Lieberman?
Well, Avigdor Lieberman is going to be a proud member of the opposition. And think about the opposition for a minute. It's being headed, the chair of the opposition is going to be Yair Lapid, former Blue and White. In the opposition, you have Yair Lapid on the one hand, Naftali Bennett and the National Union of Bezalel Smotrich, and the Joint Arab List and Lieberman. Think about this.
It's unbelievable. You couldn't write this.
It's a definition of political hell, because it's a kind of opposition that can never come together. You can see Ayman Oda of the Joint Arab List holding hands with Avigdor Lieberman, Bezalel Smotrich, and Naftali Bennett to fight off the Netanyahu government. So Netanyahu, in creating this coalition government, has been able to take all of this opposition and put them on different shelves. So none of them will actually have the power to come together unless some specific issues. The other thing is, I'm reminded of the 2013 Brothers Union. In the Netanyahu government of 2013, there was a famous collaboration. They called it an alliance, the Brothers Alliance, between Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid that threatened Netanyahu. They have a chance to reenact that on the next phase of the fifth Netanyahu government. And maybe last story, Mark, I want to share. I'm reminded by the vote today when everybody was ready and Netanyahu had to push it to Sunday of the dirty deal. The dirty deal in Hebrew, Hatargil HaMasriach, is a famous incident in 1990 when Shimon Peres tried to establish a government with the ultra-Orthodox. He was in the National Unity government with Yitzhak Shamir of Likud and then decided to topple the government and create his own left-center government with the ultra-Orthodox. So the first phase was successful. He was able to bring down the government in a vote of no confidence, the only one in Israel's history, 60 against 55 in March of 1990. And in the course of the following month, he got a promise from the ultra-Orthodox that they're going to be part of his coalition. He had a promise block of 61. Here he comes to the Knesset, for in a very rare occasion, accompanied by his wife, the late Sonia Peres. She's sitting there at the dignitaries aisle. He is coming to the, about to come on stage and announce a new government that's going to finally happen under him as prime minister. And suddenly he looks around and sees the two members of the Ashkenazi ultra-Orthodox party, Mizrahi and Verdiger, are nowhere to be seen. They claim to have taken a wrong turn in the mountains of Jerusalem or not finding their way to the Knesset. Long story short, it was an unbelievable celebration that had to be canceled there and then because, and it's interesting, it was Rav Shach, the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, along with Rabbi Milubavitch of Chabad, that decided to put a veto on that government. And what an amazing moment in Israeli history.
By the way, there is moment after moment, and you are the one who unlocks all the mysteries for us, Shachar. Thank you so much for spending a moment with us. First of all, we're going to look forward to your own program next week, but you and I are going to continue this discussion in detail after Sunday. In the meantime, you stay well, and we'll continue to talk to each other.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Be well. Shachar Azani, always a delight. So let's take a quick look at the coronavirus numbers for May 14th. In the United States, there's only been a 4% increase in cases since the beginning of the week, and the rate of recovery is up another 3% to 21%. The bad news is that there are more than 85,000 Americans who have succumbed to the virus, a rate of roughly 6%, which matches the global average. But there does seem to be a slowing down of the virus, And again, more and more states are talking about a step-by-step reopening of society, including the state of New York. In Israel, there's some very good news. In the last 3 days, only 61 additional people have been diagnosed with the disease, which is only a 0.3 rise and could mark a huge turning point for the Jewish state. When the rate of increase drops under 1%, a virus becomes far, far less potent and communicable and is on the way out. So this could be wonderful news for the state of Israel and the Israeli people. The rate of recovery in Israel is also up still further from 71% to 74% of all those diagnosed with the virus. But the global rate of recovery is only half of Israel's 35%. While the death rate in Israel continues to remain at only 1.5%, in contrast to the global death rate of 6.8%. And in fact, yesterday, not one Israeli died from the coronavirus. So you may remember that Israel was one of the first countries to close its borders and impose strict limitations on movement, and they are now reaping the benefits. Israeli schools have reopened, though many parents are continuing to keep their children at home, and wedding halls are scheduled to reopen in Israel next week with guest limits of 100. And while everyone will be watching for an uptick of cases once more and more Israelis re-enter society, things are looking up for Israel and maybe a model for other countries. We hope so. Then many of you are responding to our invitation for you to send us your simchas, persons to be mentioned in a Misha Berach, or your sites for me to mention as part of our JBS community acknowledgments. Tomorrow, May 15th, will mark the yahrzeit of Chana bat Miriam v'Avraham, the mother of a dear, dear friend, Mimi Cohen, whose husband Saul was one of the earliest supporters of L'Chaim and a longtime JBS board member who passed away last year. And I know Mimi's memories of her mother, Chana, can only be ones that bring her joy. Zecher Tzidika Livracha, may Hannah's name forever be a blessing. We also have a simcha to celebrate. Nini Yoshvi sends a mazel tov to Rebecca Maginot upon her graduation tomorrow from Indiana University School of Dentistry. Congratulations, Rebecca. And if you have any person you'd like me to mention on JBS, just send the full information to jbscommunity@jbstv.org. And to be in touch with me directly, simply email me at rabbigolub@jbstv.org. And before we close, one more mazel tov to the people of Israel and the entire Jewish family throughout the world. It was on this date, May 14th in 1948, that post-Shoah Jewish life was resurrected, given new vigor and new hope with the Declaration of Independence of the modern State of Israel, a cause for universal celebration. My thanks as always to our director, Sloan Copeland, and until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Stay safe. And be well, my friends.